It's an honor and a pleasure to introduce Rabbi Cardoza. This actually is my fourth time introducing Rabbi Cardoza this weekend. We had the good fortune of having him as a guest speaker at our shul over Shabbos. So I think I'm getting pretty good at doing this. Rabbi Cardoza, I'm just going to give a brief introduction and let him take it away. In the past 25 years, in the renaissance of Jewish learning, especially amongst Western educated, not so observantly brought up young people, in that whole renaissance, Rabbi Cardoza was a leading figure. In Jerusalem, in Or Sameach, for many years, hundreds and thousands of people came through, and Rabbi Cardoza was at the forefront of the possibility of living as a modern, educated person and at the same time be loyal to Torah and to plumb the depths of the Torah. He's the author of 11 books. He's distinguished in particular as a social critic of the Orthodox world and of the general society. He's an eloquent voice of Torah. He presently is the Dean of the David Cardoza Academy of Jewish Studies and Human Dignity in Jerusalem, lectures regularly at over 50 institutions of Jewish and secular learning around the world. It's often hosted by programs with affiliation ranging from the Orthodox Union and Union of Sephardic Communities to Oxford and Harvard Universities. He's regarded by many as a type of ambassador of conscience, and over the past 25 years attracted large number of students with his unconventional style. His fresh approach to many topics of social concern and his unswerving honesty continue to engage Jews and non-Jews alike. Yesterday, after one of the programs, a woman in our shul came up to me and said, it's a highly educated woman, comes to many learning programs, and she said to me, "Hearing Rabbi Cardoza is the most impactful Jewish experience I have ever had in my life." Rabbi Cardoza.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Fredbergs, for introducing me with these nice words. It reminds me of a story they tell about President Rosenfeld when he also got such a beautiful introduction. And he got up afterwards and he said, "My father would have liked it and my mother would have believed it." My dear friends, the title of this lecture is obviously unusual. Are we able to learn from heretics, apikorsi? And we are going to discuss some of them, crucial apikorsi within the Jewish world. But I need to introduce this properly, that you know what I'm going to do. The topic is fast, and there are enormous different dimensions to this. There are halachic issues. Is one allowed to study apikorsiut, matters which are not in according to the Jewish faith? There are issues about why at all doing that is this not a waste of time? And indeed, there is this issue which I want to discuss this morning, and that is, what can we learn from them, and what is the consequence of that? And even about these matters, there are many different ways of looking to it, and my time is limited. Let me start with the introductory words of the Rambam, of Maimonides, to the Morei Nevuchim, to the guide of the perplexed. Maimonides definitely read a lot of Epicurus, starting with the Greek philosophers, Aristotle, first of all, and many others. And it's interesting the way in which he introduces this more nevuchim, the guide for the perplexed, because it is there that he's going to deal with this problem. And he makes a profound comment which speaks to us today, are there to say, even more than it did in his days 1,000 years ago. He says, I tell you where I wrote this work. And this work, as you all know, became perhaps the most important philosophical Jewish work ever written. He says like this. We have to realize that this is 10th century, we live in days where we get challenged by many other beliefs, by many different philosophies, and we need to respond. He says, because if we don't, not only that by that we make the impression that we are scared of other people's thoughts by not dealing with them, but above all, because it becomes impossible to be genuine religious if one does not deal with these problems. He says like this, if a person is being questioned about his faith, about his emunah, and he takes it serious, which we hope he does, he will live in perplexity, guide for the perplexed. He will live in perplexity, he says, and he will remain there, but let's not make a mistake and believe that you can do that without paying a very big price, a very heavy price. Reason is obvious. Once you are challenged in your beliefs, these challenges don't just fade away. They do not just disappear. It is something which you will have to struggle with for the rest of your life, and if you are not prepared to confront them, deal with them, and find perhaps responses, then, as he calls it, the joy of being religious will be taken away from you. You will live in constant struggle and pain, which he believes is not conducive to religious living. And the Rambam goes on to explain himself about this, how important this matter is, and how much, therefore, we need to deal with issues when they confront us. Now, in these days, it was Christianity. It was the Islam. It were some of the Arab thinkers, and there were famous and important Arab thinkers. To what extent there was a real atheism as we know it today, I do not know. But there were many challenges. And it seems that the Rambam himself was worried about one fact. If we are not going to deal with them, and it seems that the majority of, let's call it, Orthodox Jews were not dealing with them at the time, we will pay a massive price, he says. And therefore, I write the More Nevuchim. If you read these words, and it's worthwhile for anybody who can read it, or in Hebrew, or otherwise in an excellent translation of Professor Pinnus and others, if you read these words, it looks like they're speaking to us today. Even more so. Issues by which we get challenged. Today we live in a world which is open to us from every perspective. We can't hide anything anymore. Just the email alone, if you know anything about what's going on philosophically on email, on websites, the challenges which come about, which our children can read, which grown-up students can read, just running away from them. You can perhaps for a moment think that you're living in a ghetto and that there you can continue your life, but it will come back to you. And if not to you, it will come back to your children. And therefore there's a need to deal with this even more today as perhaps 1,000 years ago in the case in the days of the Rambam. Now I speak about real intellectual issues. And I want to make it clear, we are not speaking about what sometimes people watch on television, which is superficial. which really doesn't say much about what really is going on. Documentaries, most of the time, are so superficial that they do not even give you the right information how to become an Epicurus. One has to realize how important that is. But there is something else which I would like for a moment just to give it some attention. Questioning is most important. Questioning your own emuna is extremely important. Not only because you have to stand up against any kind of critique which may come about, criticism, but there is something else. In America lived a very famous Christian thinker, Protestant thinker, by the name of Reinhold Niebuhr, who was very close to the Jewish community, by the way. He was a good friend of Abraham Joshua Heschel. And he once said in one of his lectures the following. He says, and I want you to hear this well, there is nothing more irrelevant than an answer to a question nobody asks. I just repeat it. There is nothing more irrelevant than an answer to a question nobody asks. And Niebuhr said like this. We are walking around possibly with loads of answers, but we don't recognize them as answers because we forgot the questions. We're not posing these questions. And what happens then is an interesting thing, and you can see this, in my opinion, today in the Jewish world. And that is this. If you don't question, but there is indeed a proper answer to the question, then what it means is that the answer which you may be reading is or misunderstood or taken on a superficial level. And by that you have lost out on what that piece of Jewish information is trying to teach you. Because there's no way of understanding anything in this world unless you question it. I'm sure all of us have learned sometimes Chumash this Russian. How do you learn a Russian? I had a great trouble when I for the first time was introduced to Russian, and the whole world is speaking about how great this Pirush of Russian on the Chumash is. I must say, I was a little impressed. And I went up to one of my rabbis at the time and I said to him, why is the whole world speaking about Rashi? I'm more impressed with some other commentators. So he said to me, and I will never forget, I tell you why. Because Rashi made one mistake, between brackets. He only came up with the answer, but he never asked the question. Why? Because he thought that you would ask that question. He didn't want to take the time to write the question down. Is it not obvious that you have to ask this or that specific question? Sure. So what I will provide you with is only, once you've asked the question, what the answer is. And I was reading the answers and didn't realize that it required first my questioning. And therefore I couldn't appreciate Rashi. And this is true about the whole of the Jewish tradition. The Jewish tradition is written in ways in which indeed most of the time we are reading answers. But the problem is because we don't realize that there are answers to questions since we have not asked these questions. Our understanding of what is being stated is basically superficial and therefore makes the impression of being simplistic. And we often will walk away and say, you know, I don't need to read that kind of stuff. It is so simplistic and let's say superficial that there's no point in reading it. No, that's not true. Sometimes just one line of a Rashi or any other of the commentators, short, to the point, maybe of tremendous profundity, but you need to ask first. Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say, and also I cannot completely agree with that, but he used to say, what is the Torah? The Torah is an answer to the ultimate questions man needs to ask. In other words, even the Torah, if I may say so, made a mistake. And what is the mistake? that when you start reading it, you're already reading the answer. And God forgave, somehow forgot to give us the questions at Sinai. But the reason why he did not give us is obvious. Human beings by nature are questioners. But in the times in which we live, and this is already going on for a long time, we may be great questioners, but we lost the questions. And here's an important point which we have to realize. To understand the Jewish tradition, you need people to ask critical questions. You need skepticism. You must have people there who look down to the text and say, what is there wrong with the text? Not because we want to prove it is wrong, but because we want to understand its final and absolute meaning. But today, very often in Jewish education around the world, and very much inside the Orthodox Jewish educational system, we pour an incredible amount of knowledge to our children. I see this in my own children, I see this in my grandchildren today. And they come home with unbelievable amount of information that sometimes I have to look it up to see if they're telling me the truth or they're making it up. And most of the time I do find it. And it's impressive. I didn't know. They do know. But if I ask them afterwards, so what made Chazal, the rabbis, to write this down? What was bothering them? Then they look to me like, wait a moment. Nobody spoke with us about that. And that's exactly where the mistake starts. If you don't create skeptical minds within our young people, I can tell you for sure, and I speak with a lot of experience, that when they're growing up, they do not appreciate what they learned because they've never understood how deep it is what they believe. Because there's a lot of depths to belief. It is not just something superficial. It goes deep into what we think and how we look to this world. It provides incredible answers. But if there's no question which introduces that, then there is a big problem. Now here we get into a very difficult, complicated situation. And then there's obviously the question, I call it, we have on one side belief poverty. We don't know even how profound it is what we are believing. And therefore we live in this kind of poverty. But on the other side, there's obviously the problem that the moment you start to ask questions, you get the issue of safek, of doubt. And if you get doubts, you will never know if you get out of it. There's always the chance that you will stick to it and you will get involved in it. And it will start at that moment to become a problem in the way how you conduct your religious life. And indeed, this is an issue. Now, first of all, we have to understand one thing. Doubt must be genuine. And we have always to realize that there are many cases in Jewish history where people ask questions, critical questions about the Jewish tradition, where they asked it not for reasons or really finding out what the answer is, but to stick with the question and not wanting to hear an answer. There is this very famous story, I'm sure that some of you must have heard this story before, Rab Chaim Soloveitchik, one of the great Brisker families, great-grandfather, or grandfather better, of Rab Yosef Beer Soloveitchik of Boston, Zichat Tzadik Livracha. Rab Chaim Soloveitchik was a master in Talmudic knowledge. He had a friend who later became a professor. And he actually walked out on the Jewish tradition. But they had learned for many years together in yeshiva. And when they met again many years later, at least that's the way how the story goes, Reb Chaim said to the professor, his friend, he said, tell me something. Why did you become irreligious? So he said, I had too many questions. And Reb Chaim, who was an excellent psychologist, said, tell me something. When you walked out, did you have the questions afterwards or before you walked out? And the professor answered, afterwards. To which Reb Chaim said, "Of a teretz kamenish kemen ken teretz." On an answer, you can't give an answer. What you are doing is exactly not what doubt is all about. If you first made up your mind that you want to become secular and then you find questions, these questions are not genuine. If you are still religious and then you ask, and perhaps for that reason you walk out, that's a different story. And we have therefore to realize that when we speak about doubt, we speak about genuine doubt, honest doubt, and indeed we need to deal with it. Now if you look around in literature, in religious literature, inside the Jewish tradition, outside the Jewish tradition, you see that some great thinkers have been dealing with this issue. The first person who ever dealt with doubt within the Jewish tradition, as far as I know, was Sa'atya Gaon. Sa'atya Gaon, going back before the days of the Rambam, some people consider him, possibly correct, as the first Jewish philosopher ever appearing. And he deals with this in great, great lengths. The pros and the contras. But also he makes the point that it is indeed required to allow yourself sometimes a doubt, not because you want to stay with the doubt, but because it is the doubt which makes you to question. And if you look back in this great tradition called the Torah and Jewish tradition, you will find the profundity of the answers given to your doubt. But if you, says Sa'atya Gaon, would not have asked that question, and you would not have gone through a moment of doubt, then you would never understood the response which the Jewish tradition gives to that doubt, as I mentioned before. In later days, two outstanding figures dealt with doubt. One in the Christian world, and one was in the Jewish world. In the Jewish world, it was the Kotzke Rebbe, Reb Mendel Meikotzke. A most unusual, strange personality. Constantly telling his students, you know what, doubt anything about what you believe. Because then it will be possible for you to become really religious. Religion doesn't mean to say that you have a nice life and you just walk, everything is in place. It is the constant struggle of living in the presence of God, and of understanding and trying to understand what this word of the Torah is all about. How do we know it is truthful, how it is honest? And also it is painful, says the Kotzke Rebbe, and his whole life was made out of pain in this respect. It is the only way how you can find some truth. Truth does not come easy to us. We today are teaching our people that they must have just emunah. And there is an issue there, what we call in Hebrew emunah peshuta. That straightforward kind of emunah. And it is true that many people can't deal with more than that, and I will not doubt that. But I also dare to say that people have got emunah peshuta, don't have a very deep emunah, at least not from an intellectual perspective. On an existential level, it may be true. But now that today we are living in a world where the university is there for all of us, where we can read academic studies on any particular matter with a tremendous amount of ביקורת, as we call it in Hebrew, a tremendous amount of critique on the Jewish tradition, we at least must allow our children who are open to this and therefore are impressed by these sort of matters to be able to have a kind of education which can deal with that problem. The other man who dealt with that in the Christian world was Søren Kierkegaard, the Danish existentialist. And it's interesting to note, and I have no time to go into this now, there's a lot of similarity between these two figures when it came to the question about emunah. So he spoke from a Christian perspective, and Lahavdil, we speak obviously from a Jewish perspective. But he writes like this: to live with one's religious commitment is to force opposition, or better, to face opposition, to dare to defy. A lack of such commitment means evading the challenge, drifting with the current. If we just move around in this world and we just believe because other people tell us to believe, that's not belief. That's, by the way, the reason why you can't inherit religion, why you can't inherit belief. You have to find it on your own. You can give your children, your grandchildren, the best kind of Jewish education, but that does not make them into genuine believers, because they just inherited from you. I believe it because my parents believe it. That's not belief. The Kotzke Rebbe is very specific about it. He says, no, you may have all the best Jewish education, but you have to rediscover it yourself again when you have the information and say, yes, I will go for this. And why? Because I've got good reasons to do so. And the Kotzker Rebbe brings a very beautiful, let's say, pasuk in the Torah to prove his point. Every morning when we read in Shachrit, we read the Ath Yashir Moshe, the Shirah Shirat Hayom. In the middle of the Shirat Hayom, you know, we say the following beautiful words. Say Keli ve'amvehu, this is my God, and I will praise him. Elokei avi ba'arom emenu. And that is the God of my father, and I will exalt him. Ask the Kotzker Rebbe, why does it first say, this is my God, and I will praise him? And then afterwards I say, it is the God of my father, and I will exalt him. Says the Kotzker Rebbe, I tell you why. First, God has to be Keli. It has to be your own God. You have to discover him on your own. Afterwards, when you look back and you say, you know what? That's also the God of my father. But not the other way around. Because otherwise, if the struggle did not take place on some level, and obviously one has to be grown up to be able to deal with the struggle, what kind of belief do we have? Just by Yerusha? By inheriting something? It is for that reason, my dear friends, and I speak with a lot of experience, that many young people today are walking out of the Orthodox community exactly for that reason. They are just being given a lot of information, but they never acquired it themselves. They didn't struggle for it, nobody told them, and nobody dealt with the struggle, and nobody taught them how to struggle. Because also that is a very important way of knowing what is right and wrong. You have to know the art of struggling with Emunah. We have to realize that you cannot, and I hope you hear well what I say, you cannot open your mind to truth without risking the entrance of falsehood. And the opposite is also true. You cannot close your mind to falsehood without risking to the exclusion of truth. That's the difficult situation in which the religious personality lives. What do you do about it? You live in doubt. You're not sure anymore. What are we going to do now? How am I going to live my life? And here comes a very interesting insight, which I say is somewhere found already clearly within the Jewish tradition. But somebody who dealt with this was the famous American philosopher by the name of William James. In his famous work, I'm sure that some of you have read it, called The Will to Believe. A marvelous essay where he does this question, the will to believe. And he speaks there about what he calls, and I have no time to go into detail, what he calls a forced option. Forced option means to say that in life, we sometimes have to decide, even when we are not sure yet. Because life needs to go on. And he goes back to Pascal, the great French philosopher, which is famous wager of Pascal, as philosophers call it. Which in very simplistic terms is saying, imagine that somebody who doubts. And this doubt, he says, I'm not sure God exists, God does not exist. How am I going to live my life? There's a big difference between living with God and without God. How do you live your life? Says Pascal, well, you have to think about the options. You can argue like this, since it is 50% possible that God exists, I will live a religious life from 6 o'clock in the morning till 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And from 2 o'clock to the afternoon till late night, I will live an irreligious life because 50% chance that he does not exist. Is this the solution? Obviously not. If God does not exist, he does not exist all the time. And if he does exist, he exists all the time. No morning and no afternoon. So says Pascal, what are you going to do? So he says, in that case, and this is perhaps a little bit more a Christian idea than a Jewish idea, but there's a certain truth to that. He says, in that case, you have got only one thing. You have to think about the risks involved. What are the risks? The risk, according to his way of saying it, is when you go after 120 years you go up there, you will find out if God exists or he did not exist. If you decided to live your whole life a religious life, and on the end you all find out that God does not exist, well, you haven't lost anything. But in the case that you have written a whole your life, a non-religious life, says Pascal, and then you go upstairs and you find out that God does exist, you may have spoiled it. So what do you need to do? Even an indecision is a decision. Even to say I'm making up my mind that I'm not going to make up my mind ultimately means that you have to take a stand. And it is herein, according to my opinion, that the halakha walks in. And there's something very remarkable. Why is it that the halakha always speaks more about the deed than about the belief? Why is it that while we no doubt speak about emunah, the Jewish tradition is first of all reflected and stated in terms of duty? The deed, the ma'aseh. You have to put on tefillin. You have to keep Shabbat. The reason is this. Because all of us are somehow doubters. Because nobody can walk around this world without having moments to doubt. We all do. But in the meantime, we have a forced option. We have to live our lives, says the halakha. Live a religious life. You're not 100% sure? That indeed is the condition of life. There's little what you can do about it. How many people can walk around this world without having any time at any moment a doubt about anything? And never forget one more thing. And that is, that if you do not doubt, you will, when you actually solve the doubt, if you did not do so because you never had the doubt, you don't even know how great it is what you are actually believing. It stays superficial. There is something which we call catharsis. Catharsis means to say, it is a concept in philosophy which means to say it pulls off, it does certain things by which afterwards suddenly a new way of looking to things come about. I want to speak with you about two figures who both lived in my hometown in Amsterdam. One became worldly known as one of the greatest secular philosophers. And another one, I'm not sure if you heard about him, but he was the forerunner of this man. The forerunner is called Uriel da Costa. And the man, the ultimate great philosopher, is Baruch Spinoza. I made a study of them from many different perspectives, but I asked myself the question, they put many doubts on the table about the Jewish tradition. What was the catharsis? What happened because of that? In what aspect? In what way did we benefit from it? And in what way did we get damaged by it? Let me for a moment speak about Uriel da Costa first. Uriel da Costa, a very interesting figure, was a man who was born in 1585 in Oporto, in Portugal. And he was raised in a Catholic family, but Jews. They were Maranos. People had been forced to live in according to the Catholic faith. But when he grows up, and his father, by the way, some kind of a priest in Oporto, but no doubt aware that there are Jews, one day, Uriel da Costa picks up a Tanakh, no doubt in the Portuguese language, and he starts to read it on his own, the Old Testament. And what happens is, he describes that himself, what happens is it's an eye-opener. He suddenly realizes what the Catholic Church has been teaching him already for years does not work. It's not the truth. And he realizes that he has to go back to the Jewish tradition, because the Jewish tradition is the tradition which comes right out of this Tanakh. And he studies it. And because of the circumstances, the Inquisition, he moves away and he goes to Amsterdam. As a proud Jew, I'm going to back to the faith of my fathers. But then something very remarkable happens. And that is this. When he arrives in Amsterdam, and he knocks on the door of the Portuguese Spanish synagogue in Amsterdam, which I'm a member of, and he walks in, and they invite him, he suddenly finds that the Yahadut, the Jewish tradition, which he had drawn out of the text of the Tanakh, did not at all agree with what the rabbis were teaching to be the Jewish tradition. Because all what he had at the time was only the text. He was reading the text, that's what it says, so that's what you do. What Uriel da Costa did not have is any information about what we call today the Torah Shebal Peh, the Oral Torah. The rabbinical understanding of the text. And that gets him into tremendous trouble. Because what happens is that he starts to have a fight with the rabbis. And he says to the rabbis, you are deliberately misreading the text to fit it to the Talmudic interpretation, which is far-fetched. And he has a real fight with them. And remember a fight in the 17th century in Amsterdam, although it was a little bit of a place of liberty, was a dangerous undertaking. The Jews just had come out of Spain and Portugal after the Inquisition, 1492. They were permitted to go to Amsterdam, but the Amsterdam City Hall made one particular condition, and that is this. You can stay here, you can even live in according to your Jewish tradition, but don't make us any trouble. Don't question Christianity. Don't question the religious faith or anything like that. Behave. But now something happens. He starts to speak with the rabbis. The rabbis hear what he has to say, and the rabbis don't know what to do about it. And what do? They put him into a harem, into a ban. They tell him, you can't say these things, we have the right interpretation of the Torah, not you. And he says, not true, have a look in the text. The text says something different from what you are telling me. And they try to convince him that that's not the case, that he's wrong, but it doesn't go. I remember one thing, a harem in Amsterdam in the 17th century, like anywhere else in the world, is a disaster. Today there's no concept anymore of a harem. Because a harem meant in these days that you were completely socially cut off in every sense possible. You couldn't speak anymore with the Jewish community. You were not allowed to do any business with them. You were not allowed to be part of any social functions or whatever it was. It was all a matter of living on your own in an island, even when you're living in the same city. Nowhere any kind of conversation taking place. And Uriel da Costa happens to have a tremendous difficult time because of that. He can't live that way. So what does he do? He goes back to the rabbi and says, okay, you're right. He only says that for one reason. He wants to be back in that community because he has got nothing else. But 1 or 2 years later, which always happens is, he starts to have again his doubts. And once more he attacks the rabbis. And they put him again into harem. I don't remember anymore how many times the man was put into harem. But you know what the end was? The last time that he was put into a harem, and then he was taken out of that harem again, when he once more said that he had done teshuvah, and he was quite embarrassed in the way how they dealt with him, which is a story on its own, he committed suicide. Made an end to his life in 1640. I left behind some manuscripts, which I come to in a moment. Tremendous tragedy. And then there is in the meantime another young man growing up in Amsterdam who became world famous, Baruch Spinoza, Benedictus Spinoza, a little later. A much stronger personality than da Costa. And he, as a young man, he starts to question also the Jewish tradition. Not for the same reasons as Uriel da Costa did. But also he is involved in this issue, is this the truth, yes or no? On the end, Spinoza breaks away from the Jewish tradition, gets a harem, perhaps the most famous harem ever given in the whole of Jewish history. He moves out of Amsterdam, writes in a little town outside Amsterdam his famous works. One of them is called the Ethics, the other one is called the Tractatus Theologico-Politicus. Some remarkable works, by the way, which we still study till this very day within the universities, and anybody who studies philosophy has read, no doubt, his works. But if you read again that story, it's a story of tremendous tragedy. Uriel da Costa, his main point is this. The rabbis are wrong in the way how they read the text, because the text says something different from what the rabbis say the text is saying. The reason is obvious. And this is the strange situation and the tragedy behind it is. That since da Costa never had any way to know about the Torah Shebal Peh, because he had never any Jewish education, And therefore was most of the time reading the Bible, if I may say so, from a what we call today a fundamentalistic perspective. This is what it says, so that is what it means. There's no flexibility in the text. He misread the whole of the Jewish tradition. Because he didn't have Talmudic background. He didn't know about the Mishnah. And the greatest tragedy is actually this. That the rabbis, and I say this with the greatest amount of respect at the time, didn't understand what was going on. They didn't realize the background. They didn't sit down with him and say to him, wait a moment, Uriel. The story is different. There is an art how you read the text of the Torah. You can't just read it like Homer, like Shakespeare. There is a particular way of doing it because the text was written within a specific tradition. And if you know the tradition, how to read it, because it is an art to read a book, and you know how to read that book in that art in which its tradition it was written, then you will understand why we say what we say. And why the Talmud basically is correct in giving the interpretation. But if you don't know about it. And they don't tell him about it because, and I have here an important point to make, because the rabbis themselves, I dare to say, did not understand the nature of the oral Torah. Now I have to be very careful what I mean by that. They knew the oral Torah. But you have to realize one thing. To know the oral Torah on one side and to know the text on the other side doesn't yet mean to say that you understand the nature of what is happening within that oral Torah. Why it reads that text that specific way. Franz Rosenzweig, one of the great later Jewish thinkers in the last century, two centuries ago by now, used to say like this, and I come later back to that if we have enough time for this. He used to say, remember one thing, you don't read the Torah, you hear the Torah. The Jewish tradition is a tradition of hearing, not of seeing. A text has music to itself. A text is a way in which it wants to externalize what is happening within, what is going on within the author, his imagination. And only what you read is the external side of that, the outer dimensions of it. But you have to know the art of reading inside. This is the most important thing, but it's hard. Anybody who has studied literature knows about this. Because we find it in every different dimension. I don't know if you know a very famous Jewish philosopher died a few weeks ago in France by the name of Jacques Derrida. And he was one of the people, a very difficult reader, by the way, a very difficult writer, by the way, who constantly made the point that you have to learn to read a text. And sometimes what the text says does not at all reflect yet what really is being said by the author who wrote the text. And that's the background to this oral Torah. Uriel da Costa does not know about it, and the rabbis at the time don't seem to understand that yet, because all of this has not yet been developed. But now I have an interesting point to make. Look around in Jewish history what happened since that day. Uriel da Costa writes a work, which is a work which is attacking the rabbis. He calls it a work of the Pharisees, a work chosen from the New Testament. The Pharisees, and he means it in the way, by the way, Spinoza does exactly the same thing, of saying these rabbis, they don't know what they are speaking about. And he goes right through the whole of the Chumash from beginning to end, and he shows all the mistakes the Talmud is making about the way how they deal with the text. I don't know how it moved around in these days. You know, the printing press was not the way as we know it today, so there must have been copies going around, and we don't know. Only a few years ago, they found this manuscript back, I think it was in Norwegian, by a professor who republished it and translated it, by the way, in English. Remarkable work. And also I cannot prove and I do not know exactly what happened to that work. What I do know is an interesting thing. If you look around in Jewish history, you will find that specifically since the 18th, 19th century, suddenly there's an outburst of literature explaining the relationship between the written and the oral Torah. Not in the ways the Talmud does, because the Talmud never discusses this matter, it just states it. But what some people did start to do is this. They said, I will prove you from the text what the Torah Shabbat Peis actually say. There was Rabbi Samson of Hirsch. There was the Malbim. There was the Torah Tumima. I'm sure that some of you have heard this. The Ketafa HaKabbalah. Some very famous people start doing that because suddenly there is a need for it. It has a lot to do with the Reform community because Reform starts to deny the oral Torah and to a great extent the written Torah. And as you know, this is an ongoing discussion today between the Orthodox world, the conservative world, and the Reform world. What is the status of the Torah Shabbat Peis? It's a complicated story, by the way. But I dare to say that it was Da Costa, by questioning this whole thing, and no doubt slowly this making a point somewhere around Europe, that the rabbis were required to respond to the challenge. And they did. And they did very well. And afterwards, I shall not go into this now, you will find even today in non-Jewish literature, biblical literature, you find people writing on this particular topic which they would never have done a long time ago. Why? Because even in biblical scholarship, and I do not mean to say but that biblical scholarship is the same as Jewish scholarship of Tanakh and of the Torah, but you will see that even people, the great people in that field today in Harvard and all these other places, they are writing from the perspective of some kind of Torah Shabbat Peis, because indeed they say, look to the text. The text is telling you there is a Torah Shabbat Peis. But you have to know how to read it. So I dare to say the following. We benefited tremendously from the critique of people like Uriel Da Costa. His own life was a tragedy. And if the rabbis would have known better, and again once more, it is easy for me to say this now, and I definitely say this with the greatest amount of respect, but if they would have given it more attention at the time, perhaps Uriel Da Costa would not have walked out. Go to Spinoza for the few more minutes we have. Spinoza is a much greater figure. Spinoza is a genius. Spinoza is a tremendously independent mind. Is a man who is prepared to take enormous risks. He gets the theorem, and he reacts to it in a very gentleman-like way. He really doesn't care. He leaves the Jewish community. By the way, he writes a lot of things in the Tractatus Theologicae Politicus, which are incorrect about the Jewish tradition. And no doubt it is because he was in many ways hurt by the Jewish tradition, or better, by the Jewish community in Amsterdam, for having him let go and throwing him out. And there's a lot of discussion about the question, why they threw him out? Did they throw him out only because of what he said? Or is it because the social circumstances at the time required that, because they couldn't keep a man like that inside the Jewish community without bringing the whole Jewish community in great trouble with the civil authorities in Amsterdam? Long story, no time to go into now. But Spinoza is much more to the point. In the Tractatus Theologica Politicus, which is a marvelous, very clear written work, Spinoza does several things. A, he denies the existence of God, at least the personal God, like we know him. He, as you all know, Spinoza is the man who created what we call intellectual pantheism. God and the world are one and the same. And not that God created the world, but also he is a tremendous critic of halacha. In the 7th chapter in the Tractatus, Spinoza writes, the halakha only functioned and had a meaning to function, a purpose, as long as the Jews were living in the country, in the land of Israel. Because it was a way by which the rabbis were able to keep these people under constraint. And therefore, as long as it was there, they created by a kind of state law. That's what Spinoza believes the halakha really is. It is a state law, and even the rituals which we have to keep are only there to keep them under constraint. And then he says another thing, and he does a tremendously unfair job there, because he starts to say, look to Christianity. Christianity has all this beautiful emuna. This man called Jesus has a tremendous meaning to what life and what religious life is all about, and the rabbis, and better the prophets, and especially Moshe Rabbeinu, Lahavdil, I have to say, he didn't understand the meaning of what it means to live a religious life. Because religious life, says Spinoza, is the quality of the soul and not what you do. It's not what the ma'asim are all about. And he goes on and he goes on and he writes well. And he makes very critical comments. At the time when Spinoza wrote this, and he got himself into trouble with the rabbis in Amsterdam, not one of them seemed to have responded properly to it. It's a little bit remarkable, because there was one man there, by the way, Menashe ben Israel, who later was the man who brought the Jews back to England, and who was quite a prolific writer himself. Even he didn't manage somehow to keep Spinoza in the fold. And he was gone. And you know, the moment, like when people like that are gone, they get even more bitter. And they start to attack even more, and sometimes they lose balance, and no doubt Spinoza is losing balance. But it doesn't take away from the fact that Spinoza made some very important comments about the halakha. This halakha is purely nothing more than a law which tells people to keep, you know, going. It's a kind of a way of which you observe things, and it is basically to obey or not to obey, and there is little spirituality to it. Till this man Jesus came, and he somehow saved the Jews of this attitude. Badly enough, Spinoza was totally wrong about it. And he was trying definitely at the time, by the way, to make a good point for himself in the liberal Christian communities in Amsterdam, which became his new friends. But besides all that, Spinoza did something, in my opinion, which is really remarkable. We benefited tremendously from what he wrote. And I tell you why. Because indirectly or directly, and I'm not sure about it, it pulled off within the Jewish community the need to look once more to what I call the philosophy of halakha. The philosophy of halakha is not that you explain why we keep mitzvot. It is trying to discuss one question. What is the nature of halakha? And only a few people ever dealt with that. Look throughout the whole of Jewish history. Up till our days, the 21st century, the 21st century, nobody ever wrote about the nature of halakha. They wrote about ta'amei hamitzvot, that is to say, the explanation of the commandments. They wrote about most fantastic forms of musar. But the question about the ideology, why is it that the Jewish tradition expresses its religiosity in the form of halakha, nobody discussed. Till our days. Three figures stand out over here. And I would suggest, if you have an opportunity, to read them. Some of them are less readable, and also ones are more difficult stuff. The most famous man who dealt with this problem for the first time was what we call today in America the Rav. Rabbi Soloveitchik. In his halachic man, Isha Halacha, he deals exactly with that issue. And also he doesn't quote quite often Spinoza, the truth about it is that I'm sure, 100% sure, that Rabbi Soloveitchik carefully read Spinoza from beginning to end and understood the critique which was going on over there and tried to respond, and did that, by the way, in a marvelous way. But I must add to that, that this work is very difficult to read, because if you don't have a background in philosophy, especially in German philosophy, you will not understand what he's trying to say. But there was another person who also wrote about this. And interestingly enough, this was a person not in the Orthodox world, but in the conservative world. But a man himself who lived an Orthodox life. The man I mentioned before. Abraham Joshua Heschel, the famous professor in the GTS, Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, who wrote, between many fantastic works, one work called God in Search of Man. Which is, by the way, a must for anybody who's intellectually interested, even when you're Orthodox, because most of it, 99.9% of what Heschel writes, is kosher. Whatever that word means, I find this a very dangerous word to say. But anyway, the truth about it is that Heschel has an unbelievable power of language by which he gives poetry to the halakha. And he explains it in a most fantastic and very sophisticated way. And it is more easily, let's say, understood, or can be understood, than what Rabbi Soloveitchik was writing. Because Rabbi Soloveitchik was writing really as an academic. And here Heschel writes more for the general population. But it's fantastic. Because he gives a deep insight, and by the way, Heschel on many occasions attacks Spinoza openly, quotes him and says to him, here you're wrong. You're misunderstood. And the great tragedy once more is that at the time the rabbis who had to deal with Spinoza did not understand what Spinoza was dealing with, and therefore did only one thing, threw him out instead of keeping him in and discussing it with him in a way as it should have happened. But once more, I say this with respect, because what would I have done if I would have lived in the 17th century and not know about all these matters? And the third man who wrote about this, who is now interestingly getting more famous than when he was alive, is Professor Eliezer Berkowitz. In a book of his, which is, by the way, just republished again, called God, Man and History. There also he deals with this issue. A little bit more to the side, I would say, in my opinion, to Heschel than to Rabbi Soloveitchik. But these are the only three people who dealt with it. Perhaps I should add to that the man I mentioned before, and that is Franz Rosenzweig, who in his own way also dealt somehow with the concept of halakha in his great discussion about halakha with his friend Martin Buber. Buber, who had walked out altogether on halakha, didn't believe in halakha. Franz Rosenzweig, who became a Baal Teshuva somehow, as we probably know the story, was a man who was dedicated to the halakha, perhaps not to the extent as we from an Orthodox point would do, but he got very close. But I dare to say, all of them read Spinoza. And I dare to say more than that. If you read their works, you can be nearly sure that while they were writing it, they had Spinoza's Tractatus in front of them. It looks as if they were commenting on him. And my point here is, my dear friends, is this. If Spinoza would not have been there, perhaps we would never heard about Rabbi Soloveitchik and about these people writing about these particular issues, because it may be that they never came out. And so we benefited from the critique. But obviously it is a tragedy at the same time that Spinoza had to leave altogether. And that Uriel Ver Costa walked out altogether. And we have, by the way, to be careful that today when we have people like that, we should not make the same mistake again. But keep them by all means inside and have discussions, and hopefully in that way that they will be able to indeed give more benefit and to be more productive for the Jewish tradition than instead against the Jewish tradition. I will add for the few words which I have something I would like to have an hour for. But I need to say it just for the moment, especially because of maybe the discussions later in the day. And that is this sensitive issue. You can only understand the Jewish tradition when you are living in the world of creativity. When you do not just take that information in and then say that's what it is, but it can only be understood and appreciated when we constantly keep on working on it, when it moves forward. And I'm not speaking in terms of reform, and I'm not speaking in terms even of the conservative movement, I'm speaking from within the Orthodox world. The need to be mechadesh, to constantly see novel ideas within the Torah, because there is an endless amount of opportunity there. You know, Plato writes an interesting thing. He writes in one of his works that he wrote, as you probably all know, the dialogues. It's a dialogue where people speak to each other. And philosophers have been asking, why did Plato write down his philosophy in the form of a dialogue? Why did he not write a book like you and I would be writing? And Plato explains that himself. And by that, Plato comes very close to the Jewish tradition. He said like this, because the problem is this. The word is always a word of stagnation. Whatever you write down gets fixed. It gets frozen. It is all what it is. That's exactly what Uriel da Costa had to go through. It got frozen to him, and therefore he believed that the rabbis were wrong. And what you have to do is, you have to somehow take the word and unfreeze it. You have to take it out of its stagnated condition. And Plato said, therefore, the word of the mouth is much more important than the word which is written. What is written is fixed. What is said, ba'al peh, from the same word as Torah Shebaal Peh, has the opportunity, the possibility that it will continue to play its music, because what is said is said, obviously, in a different dimension than what is written. There is a concept which in German is called Sprachlesen, which means to say you read something like it is being said, not being read, not being written. Plato says, therefore, I will write as little as possible in my dialogues, and what I will do is, afterwards, I will ask the people after that to try to understand what lies behind that word of mine. So how little more I can say, the better it is. Because whatever I fix, ultimately will be misunderstood. It gets a life on its own, and it moves off, and it will not any longer be what it originally was meant. By the way, that's exactly what happens in our Torah. The Torah is a work of very few words. It is very small. It doesn't have much text. What is most important is to read between the words. But then there's a problem. How do you do that? Because obviously you can easily misread the text. And it has happened all the time. And you have to pick up, and this is a long story in itself, but you must make sure about one thing. Once you have learned enough within the world of the Talmud and the world of the Chumash, and you get an understanding of the music lying behind that particular text, if then you can come up with a chidush, with a new novel insight, please do so. That's the way how our Mefarshim, our commentators throughout the years, created an incredible amount of literature on the basis of that text. And here I come to something, and I say this is great respect. And I want you to hear this well, and if you repeat me afterwards, please be careful the way how you do it. I've been more in trouble when people misquoted me. The Torah is covenantal reading. It is reading in a covenant. It is reading of a covenant. Of people speaking. Of God speaking to man. Rabbi Shach of Ponovitch Yeshiva, a man who I greatly admire, Sefer Tzadik Livracha, no longer alive, once attacked openly Rabbi Saul Weizik in letters of his, which anybody of us can read. And where he attacked Rabbi Saul Weizik in a very disturbing way. Rabbi Saul Weizik had, between many things, written his famous Chamesh Drashot. Don't know if anybody of you have read it, the Five Discourses, which is an attempt to explain why he became a religious Zionist. And he did that on the basis of the story of Yosef HaTzadik and his brothers. The brothers went one way, and Yosef went another way. And interestingly enough, he said, he implied, I am the Yosef. And he recreates and retells the whole story of the ideological differences between Yosef HaTzadik and the also 11 brothers. And by that he uses that as to make people to understand why Rabbi Soloveitchik, by the way, left the Aguda and went over to the Mizrahi. Now, I'm not going to any religious politics here. Rabbi Shach, in a letter, starts to get very upset with Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he says like this, I have it in front of me over here. I wonder at the fact that so much time has passed since the publication of this work, and the rabbis of America have not responded to his words, which contain things which are forbidden to hear, and which are certainly forbidden to disseminate publicly for young people to learn. For example, and then he goes through many different examples, which you shall not go into now. And even more, I'm dismayed in how the mind of a man in our generation can be filled with ideas and thoughts which he devises from his own mind, which were not handed down from the earlier generations. These things are forbidden to hear, and certainly to write for the generations. I only record them in order to demonstrate to what extent external wisdom can cause a distortion and veering away from Da'at Torah, whatever that means. Now I want you to hear this well, and that's where I stop. Rabbi Shach was a tremendous Talmid Chacham, tremendous Sadiq is reading Rabbi Shmuel Weizik and objects against one thing. The concept of chidush. What has not been said in the past is not allowed to be said in the future. My dear friends, with all respect, Rabbi Shmuel Weizik is right. And Rav Shach is wrong. He is wrong because of one reason. If we start to take that note, that way of looking to the Torah, we stagnate it, and we're going to say, this is what it is, and there's nothing more to it, then we take the life out of this tradition. And we are never allowed to do that. I agree, and I understand Rav Shach is concerned that if tomorrow anybody starts to write his own pirush on the Torah, we get a lot of nonsense. Absolutely true. But not with a man like Rabbi Shmuel Weizik, who had the Talmud at his fingertips with all the commentators. And that is the interesting thing about this man. Unbelievable secular amount of knowledge, which helped him to defend and to explain the Jewish tradition properly. There we have to be careful, because if we want our young people to continue to live this life, we must allow them for the novelty. We must allow them for the possibility of working their own creative minds on the text within the tradition, within the Masoret. But if we tell people you're not allowed to say anything on your own, you can only repeat what people have said before, we are, with all respect, making a mistake. Let's therefore hope that indeed, even when we read Apikorsiut, and I'm not saying you should, but if you are still reading heretics, heretical ideas, then remember one thing. Always think about how and in what way can it help us to explain the Jewish tradition, and I mean by that, first of all, the Orthodox Jewish tradition, better. Because every attack made on us, the response which we can give is so profound that ultimately it adds to the kavod, to the honor of the Torah. Thank you very much.
I thank Rabbi Cardoza for a wonderful presentation. We don't have time for questions. Everyone's invited upstairs. Rabbi Lam will be giving the only keynote address of today's conference. That'll be at 12 o'clock sharp upstairs. Everyone's invited there. You're reminded that there are CDs for purchase upstairs, and there are evaluation forms which we ask you to fill out and hand in over the course of the day. Thank you.